Thanks a lot, Kyle. So I'm one name among many for this project here because it was a statewide project, product of the California Department of Public Health in a collaboration with my laboratory, the San Francisco Department of Public Health. I'm on the San Francisco Department of Public Health Laboratory, I should say. I'm on the laboratory side of this, and I'm giving the talk because people from the California Department of Public Health couldn't make it, I guess mostly because of financial reasons. But the problem that we face, and what we're all interested here, is cephalosporin resistance and gonorrhea. And one of the main issues, the scope of the problem as we now have it, is that when we lose cephalosporins, we will face basically gonorrhea that is extremely difficult to treat, if not impossible. The scope of the problem epidemiologically or geographically is that we've had documented treatment failures in Asia for well over a decade to oral cephalosporins, and in the last few years we've had documented treatment failures in Europe. Now, we do not have any documented treatment failures to cephalosporins yet in the United States, nothing recorded. But I think we have to assume, we'd be wise to assume, that it's either, if it isn't on our doorstep, it's already here. But seeing where the United States is positioned in the middle of this problem, I think as public health professionals, we have both a responsibility and an opportunity to do something. And the project I'm going to talk about today, this collaboration with the California Department of Public Health and the San Francisco Department of Public Health, is one effort that we have to stave off this problem, or at least try to make some effort to do something about it. Now, before I get into the project, I thought I would give, because I'm the first speaker of the session, I'll give a brief overview of the problem. This slide is a chronology of drug resistance and gonorrhea. This is really the chronology of what you might call an arms race, a genetic or evolutionary arms race between gonorrhea and pharmacology. In the 1980s, we lost penicillins to resistance. We threw more penicillin at it, and gonorrhea evolved an even greater resistance to penicillins. In the 90s, we had our first reports of failures to fluoroquinolones. Across that same time period, we learned that gonorrhea very easily develops resistance to tetracyclines. In 2002, in California, we lost fluoroquinolones for treatment of gonorrhea. Now, by that time, in 2002, when we lost fluoroquinolones, we had already been 3 years out after our first treatment failures to oral cephalosporins in Japan. In 2007, we lost fluoroquinolones in the rest of the United States. In 2010, in response to what we see as an impending problem, the CDC recommended dual treatment with azithromycin and cephalosporins. Now we're in the 2010s, and we're left with the yellow box, and that is, what is the status of cephalosporin resistance in the United States? And this project I'm going to talk about today is an effort in California to try and answer that question. So I'm going to talk about a statewide protocol that was implemented to detect isolates of gonorrhea with a decreased susceptibility to cephalosporins and an effort to respond clinically and epidemiologically to the detection of those isolates. Whatever we know right now in the United States about drug resistance in gonorrhea for Neisseria gonorrhea all comes from a CDC project called GISP, the Gonococcal Isolate Surveillance Project. This has been a very successful project running for, almost three decades now. GISP monitors trends in antibiotic resistance by having 28 clinical sites around the United States. The isolates are collected from urethral swabs from men. Those swabs are sent to regional CDC laboratories where they are cultured in the presence of seven different drugs at a variety of concentrations so that what is determined is what is called a minimum inhibitory concentration. That is the smallest amount of drug needed to kill the organism in vitro. When those MIC, we call those MICs, when those MIC values creep up to a certain number, we call to a certain threshold where we think that is correlates with potential treatment failure, we call that an alert value. Now, we aren't certain right now what the alert values are for azithromycin or the cephalosporins, but these are right now our best guesses based on data from the Clinical Laboratory Standards Institute for the most part. If you look at GISP data gathered since 1987, and you look at the history of alert value detection with GISP, You can see here a year on the x-axis and percentage of isolates with alert values on the y-axis. And you can see that there's a couple of hills and valleys along the way, but the problem really punctuates in the last few years. And the problem, obviously, is rather due to an increase in alert values to oral cephalosporins. Now, there's asterisks over 2007 and 2008 because CDC didn't include oral cephalosporins in just for those 2 years. If you break the problem down into, again, GISP isolates all come from men. They're your urethral swabs. If you look, there are at the data, break it down between the isolates derived from men who have sex with men and men who have sex with women. The problem is a bit more acute in the isolates derived from men who have sex with men, but it's obviously a punctuation that is occurring in both populations. The California protocol is an effort to use the laboratory to rapidly identify GC isolates, identify isolates with alert values to cephalosporins and azithromycin, and to rapidly respond by giving that data to our clinical partners and performing clinical and management and epidemiologic investigations or follow-up, basically, to the detection of those isolates. Now, schematically, the collaboration looks like this. The California Department of Public Health, as I said, produced the project. We are the laboratory arm of the project over here at the San Francisco Department of Public Health Lab. We're just across the bay from where this operation is in Richmond. These are the sites where isolates were collected. Sorry to shoot you in the head with a laser, Kyle. San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Orange County collected isolates. Basically, they're GISP isolates, although we did allow any isolate that they generated, not just a GISP isolate. And they would be sent to us where we tested them, and then we would disseminate the data back to these partners. So this is just the text of really what I just said. So as they are collecting isolates at those sites for their GISP, they would send them to us. We would do rapid antimicrobial susceptibility testing. We'd get the results back to them with basically spreadsheets with alert notifications, and then clinicians and epidemiologists would then respond to the data. How are we able to do this on the lab side so quickly? Well, one of the main reasons we were able to turn these around more quickly in our laboratory was because we used, a methodology called e-test. And I'm going to show you a picture of that in the next couple of slides. One of the other things we did in the lab, which I'm not going to talk about here, but I have a talk tomorrow on this, is we did a parallel study as we collected all of these isolates over 2011, where we generated their phenotypes, right, their MIC values, but at the same time did molecular testing on them to look for molecular correlates to this so that we could utilize or at least better understand the potential use of a PCR to detect this resistance rather than having to use culture. And as I said, I'll talk more about that tomorrow. E-test is a way to, in one plate, for one isolate, determine the MIC value. Normally, this is done by a method called agar dilution, which requires many tubes at many concentrations. So you would need as many as 12 or 15 cultures to determine the MIC value for one drug for one isolate. But here you can, in one plate, determine what the MIC value is. This is a suffixime strip. It has increasing or decreasing amounts of suffixime in the strips. So you have high concentration of drug and a low concentration of drug. You can see this is what we might call a wild type or a non-resistant GC growing in a chocolate agar plate. And you can see this does not want anything to do with even the lowest concentrations of suffixime. This is a cefpodoxime strip, and it's the same deal over here. This wild type organism doesn't want really anything to do with it. So the growth is well away from the strip. This is an isolate which we found in 2008 in San Francisco, which we would say has a decreased susceptibility to oral cephalosporins. And you can see it grows right up against the strip here, and for cefpodoxime here, this is an MIC of 0.75 and an MIC of suffixime of 0.19. So the e-test facilitates the testing. It allows us in a few days, just a few days, to get the MIC value for the isolate on a particular drug. Anyhow, when we would determine the MIC values, if we were to find an alert value, there was then those alert values would get forwarded to the clinicians and the epidemiologists. And there were really two follow-up protocols that would then be followed. Now I'm a little bit out of my element as a lab scientist, but we'll kind of read off the slides as we go. The protocol A is the more intensive response. So this is what would happen on the clinical side if, for example, there was a ceftriaxone alert isolate, or if somebody had an alert value on their isolate that was for the treatment that they were given. In those cases, the patient would be called up for an interview. They were given clinical follow-up, which you can see is in the next two lines here. And if possible, the partners were tested and treated. Clinical follow-up meant that clinical follow-up included test of cure and in some cases retreatment if necessary. The less intensive protocol was for any other alert value, like for a cefixime or cefpodoxime, if they had not been given cefixime or cefpodoxime. Those cases are called for interview, and their partners were called to verify that they were treated. In the course of 2011, we tested 711 isolates. There were 34 alert values, two of them were azithromycin. 32 were to either an oral cephalosporin or ceftriaxone or some combination of the two. The timeline looked like this. From the time the specimens were collected to the time that our laboratory was able to generate MIC results was a median of 17 days. From the time we generated MIC results to a case interview and a follow-up, the median was 14, or 6 to a test of cure. The alert case follow-up, as it has occurred so far, there were 18 cases of those 34 alert values where some form of follow-up did occur. There were for 11 ceftriaxone alerts, 73% of them were interviewed. 5 of those people had a test of cure that were all negative. There were 7 other alerts, and 3 of them were interviewed, and because those alerts were for the less intensive of the two response protocols, there was no test of cure follow-up. And that's the end, and I'll be happy to, take questions at the very end, Kyle?
No, you have questions.
We
have time for a couple questions.
So was that 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
No questions? Well, there'll also be time at the end for questions if a question comes up in front of the other speakers. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.